Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part.
Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by graduate students and supported by the American Fisheries Society and the Fisheries Podcast, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries.
We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own.
Humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong.
We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome, everyone, to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. I am here as one of your co-hosts today, Leon Gua, and also here is my other co-host, Aaron Bunch.
Hello, everyone.
Dr. Andrea Reed is an Indigenous fisheries scientist and conservation biologist based in Canada. She gave an absolutely amazing plenary at the AFS virtual annual meeting. And so honestly, in my eyes, she is like a rock star. I am so excited to be able to talk with her today about her experiences in fisheries and just to get some more insight from her. So welcome.
Thank you so much. I did my best to not burst out laughing during the intro. No, it's my pleasure to be here. It is great to see increasing attention and interest in the area of Indigenous fisheries science. So thanks for making the time.
I'd like to second comments that Leon made about your plenary at the virtual annual meeting. It was very good, and thank you for that.
Enjoyed delivering it, and it was great to see, feedback from across North America and in actually around the world. That was really positive. So good to see interest around the globe.
Yeah, I was especially excited to see that Canada Day, you know, they chose as one of their plenaries specifically to have you to talk about Indigenous frameworks of looking at fisheries science. And this is really important because I know when we've looked back in the past at, for example, American Fisheries Society and what percent of our membership are Native American is the term we generally use in the United States. Our membership is just below like 1% membership Native American. And in the entire United States, I pulled up some stats because I really wanted to know, you know, like, are we doing a good job of representing that population? And about 2% of the entire US population identifies as either full or part Native American or Alaska Native. And I thought it was really interesting because since you are in Canada, I wanted to look up, you know, what the percent was in Canada. And actually, there's a higher percentage, just below 5% of the total population are Aboriginal people, was the term I saw used, Indigenous peoples. You know, we honestly don't come into contact with very many Indigenous people within fisheries. And I think obviously that's a huge loss on our part. So I would really love to hear from you. How has your experience been as an Indigenous person in academia and then also specifically the fishery science profession?
Yeah, well, those are some excellent questions and good reflections, to be sure. In North America, if we look back at our history, I mean, these are Indigenous traditional territories, coast to coast to coast to coast, right? And the fact that the percentages of Indigenous representation in our countries is so low is really reflective of that colonial history and of purposeful policies to reduce the quote unquote Indian population, right? Like in Canada, we have the Indian Act, which has been purposefully made in a specific way so that in just two generations, you can lose your status by having one generation marry out and then that next generation marry out and have kids that are of non-Indigenous descent. You can lose your status just so quickly. And it's really part of this colonial history and then the aftermath of that to reduce that population. And so it's a really difficult kind of present that we live in when we know that it's tied to that past. But to your question about my experiences in academia, I really want to preface this by saying that the listeners can't see me now, but I am definitely a white-coated individual. I'm both Indigenous and white. I am a descendant of the Gisgask clan, the killer whale clan of the Nisga First Nation on the border of British Columbia and Alaska. But I didn't grow up there, in large part due to colonial histories and an aftermath. Like I just mentioned, my grandmother was taken from the community to the Kokolitsa Industrial School as a child. My father was part of the 1960s scoop where he was adopted into a white family who was really wonderful and loving, and he had a really wonderful childhood in many respects, but grew up without that part of his history and culture and didn't even have that knowledge of where he came from. I, as a consequence of those things, grew up far from Nisga community, culture, ceremony, language. And so I've been finding my way back, actually through my science, through my work on fish and fisheries, back to community. And so my experience in academia is one that's probably very different from most Indigenous scholars, especially people of color in North America, who face a great deal of racism and discrimination. I have had the privilege to have Western scientific training through my undergrad, through my master's and my PhD, found my way back into community in the process of that work. So I've gained this privilege to kind of speak both languages, to have my foot securely placed in kind of each world. But not everyone can move so easily between those two spaces, and academia is not an easy place to come into with when you come from a different worldview, when you have such a different set of experiences that don't align really easily and nicely with Western science that prevails in our institutions in North America.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I often think about how there's always certain people in the room when we're talking about our science or the outreach that we're doing, because there literally are some people who are not in the room. Their ways of viewing the world and their ideas are just not represented and essentially erased, you know, from our science. And that really concerns me because it means that we are losing a lot of things that we don't even know what we're losing. It's you know, especially having Indigenous representation in fisheries when we work with tribes, at least we hope to work with them very often. It's so concerning to me that we don't have higher membership within the society, for example. So thank you for sharing that. I thought that was really interesting. You mentioned a term, white-coated, and I think perhaps our viewers may not necessarily know exactly what that means. So would you mind just elaborating a little bit on what that means?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's really this ability to present as white and to be perceived in that way. And so that has all of these influences on the way that I move through the world that I'm not even aware of. There are different terms for it. I tend to use white-coated. It's the term that I kind of see the most used in my spaces. But it's really important to acknowledge that part of my positionality because, like I said, I don't share the same reality that someone with brown or black skin does. There's a really wonderful writer that I adore, Alicia Elliott, who has this beautiful book called A Mind Spread Out on the Ground. In that book, I've often quoted her in similar contexts because I think she's just got a powerful way of kind of capturing this sentiment. But she says, being both Haudenosaunee and white wasn't a curse meant to tear me in two. It was a call to uphold the different responsibilities that come with each part of me. I didn't need to worry about whether to get in the boat or the canoe, and I certainly didn't need to drown in between. Understanding and honoring my unique responsibilities was always the way to keep myself afloat. And I just think that people have complex identities today, given the complex history of colonization and everything in this country and in these countries. Both of these really are part of my identity and my heritage, and I'm not walking away from one in favor of the other. It's really about how I come to terms with that and reconcile that for myself.
Wow, those words are beautiful. Yeah, I am also a mixed race. So I have experienced the oddity, I suppose, of someone looking at my name and thinking that I'm a Chinese man, because it's a very Chinese name. And then they look at my face and they think that I am some sort of maybe Latina or Pacific Islander. It's never white and it's never Chinese. So it's always something else random. And then of course there's how I see myself, which is at, like, as you said, kind of both of these things melding together. And I do want to be able to uphold both parts of myself. And I think in academia, where it is so important, you know, what you look like, what your name is, it's kind of hard. It definitely is something that I've had to think a lot about it ever since, you know, having that importance being thrust on my name when you're publishing or when you're applying for jobs and people think you're one thing and then you think of yourself as something else. It's a very complicated thing to work through.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, I guess that's part of the power of the term white-coated. And though it can be a bit debated and people feel various things when they hear those terms, it's really just meant to be distinct from being white. Because if I were to just describe myself as that is not my identity. It really is the whole of me, which is many things, just like you described, Leon.
What are some of the differences in the ways Indigenous communities view fishery sciences compared to what you've encountered outside of the Indigenous community?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's definitely something that I've thought about a lot. And I definitely need to reiterate that kind of caveat that I presented earlier, that because I didn't grow up there, my perspective is really that of someone who came from outside of my Indigenous community and have found my way back. But given my area of research and my interest in Indigenous scholarship and the role of Indigenous fisheries in our study and management of fisheries, this is something I've reflected on a great deal. I think I see really like three main things that really define different perspectives. And there's certainly a lot more out there that I could add, but I think the three main things that I would point out is the first is just the way in which fish and fisheries are understood and how that relates to worldview when fish are viewed as a commodity and as a resource versus when they're positioned as a relative or a gift that's being given. That really redefines the nature of the relationship and has such an impact on how one might study it or manage or steward it, even how one talks about it. Like here I am using the word it when really in a lot of my writing, when I talk about salmon specifically, given the connection of to salmon for my people, I often talk about who, because salmon are They're viewed as relatives. They're viewed as, we identify as salmon people, and they are so much more than an inanimate object to be talked about in this kind of objective way. Another main defining feature I find is just the separability of humans from nature versus seeing those things as profoundly interconnected. In the Western science view, nature is often thought of as being controllable, that it can be fully known, that it can be truly managed in a way that is predictable. And I think that that is so kind of completely polar opposite to many Indigenous worldviews that see people as profoundly interconnected with nature. There's no clear kind of divisions there. And then the last thing that I would point out is Western science and fisheries that stem from that worldview really move us towards a really unidirectional view where we view ourselves as needing the fish and that it only kind of moves in that direction versus an idea that surrounds reciprocity, that both, like, we, yes, of course we need fish, but maybe they need us too, that maybe there are these ways that we reciprocally benefit from this relationship. And it's kind of this idea behind the land needs guardians, that humans are here and have a role to play as stewards, as caretakers of lands and waters, and that the land is not always impoverished because of our activities. There are things that we can do to make things better and to create a more positive environment for humans and for the more than human.
The interconnectedness with nature part is really interesting. I've never really thought of it that way in terms of the difference between Western science and a unidirectional view versus the other ideas that you just described. That's really important, I think, for people to understand in this context and with these indigenous communities. And
yeah, absolutely. But there's so much, I could talk about this for days and hours. There are so many ways that they're just profoundly different. I mean, when you grow up on the water, so many people that I've spoken to over the course of my doctoral research. I had the privilege to interview elders and knowledge keepers across the province of British Columbia about their relationship to salmon and about the changes that they've seen in their lifetimes. In so many cases, elders would have learned to fish from the moment they could walk. That was the most common response to how they kind of came into this world. When you're engaged in the fishery from your first steps, and that it's something that defines even just how you perceive the whole annual cycle, that I had many elders describe the entire year in terms of fish and the fishing activities tied to the different seasons. In Nisga Nation, many of our months are named after the different life stages or species of fish in our territory. And so it just really is profoundly part of how one is and how one exists. And I think that's really different than a lot of people who come into the fisheries profession through other means outside of community necessarily, that we, you know, go through the educational system, we find our way into fish and wildlife programs at colleges or universities and kind of come into it in adulthood. I think it's just it results in a profoundly different way of interacting with the resource or relative.
Andrea, I had another question for you as a follow-up. How do the indigenous peoples that you have studied view fishing regulations?
Yeah, I mean, I can comment on it. First, I'm going to throw out just another caveat out there that there's a huge diversity of indigenous cultures and nations in the United States and Canada and around the world. And there are times where we talk about parallels in worldviews because there are certainly some that exist, but we also need to be super careful about not painting with too broad a brush. These cultures have separate knowledges, languages, traditions, and there's a rich diversity there that we need to be careful not to wade into the pan-Indigenous waters and kind of thinking that they're all one and the same. I think that in many cases for Indigenous peoples that I've had the privilege and pleasure to work with, but for peoples across the country, across the continent, and around the world, there really is a separation for many between the communities and the governance of the fishery. A reality for many communities that I've worked with is that regulations are prescribed elsewhere, right? They come from Ottawa, our nation's capital. They come from this external perspective and not from within community. Prior to colonization, our fisheries were governed through Indigenous law and Indigenous structures and languages and worldviews that have been profoundly disrupted through the process of colonization. And so I think it's difficult to say how regulations at large are perceived, but there is really that reality of them being externally imposed. And so when it's not coming from within the community, that automatically can create just so much opposition. Bob Johannes's work of bring fishers on board or miss the boat kind of thing. If you really want to see policy change, you need to bring in the people who are at the heart of the fishery. I think that's really the key to effective regulation. If we co-develop practices and policies with communities on board, I think we're going to see a real change in the way people adhere to those policies, the collective will to respect those kind of boundaries, because they're not just externally imposed, but then also coming from within.
When you were giving your virtual annual meeting plenary, I think this is where I heard this, but you talked a bit about, and forgive me, please correct me if I say this incorrectly, the Mi'kmaq lobster conflict. Is that how you would pronounce?
You'd pronounce it Mi'kmaq.
So I honestly know Facebook is stalking me because since I looked at least one article after the talk, I've been getting some of the follow-up articles about this and about, and I don't know, you know, all the details, but I believe you spoke about how there were lobstermen who were going out, who are outside of the tribes, going out and picking up all of the tribes' lobster traps and bringing them to shore and essentially not letting any of the indigenous fishermen complete their fishing as they are by law allowed to. And there's just been a lot of conflict going on around this. Could you give us any more background?
Happy to talk about this a little bit and to share a little bit of what I know, but I definitely don't want to get too deep in the weeds in that I am not there on the ground. I'm not an expert in who all the key players are, but I can certainly kind of bring some people up to speed and encourage people to go out and read about this and to get engaged with what's happening here, but it's happening in communities across the continent. So it's a lived reality for many. But in the Canadian context, we have this important Supreme Court of Canada decision in 1999 called the Marshall decision that affirmed an Indigenous right to commercially fish for a moderate livelihood, that Indigenous peoples could participate in commercial fisheries. Up until that time, the constitutional right to fish for Indigenous peoples in this country was explicitly for food, social, and ceremonial purposes. So this was kind of an extension of that previous Supreme Court of Canada decision. But while this decision was made in 1999, since that time, there's been no inroads made, no pathway for Indigenous fishers to obtain a license to obtain a moderate livelihood. So there's been no pathway to exercise this constitutionally protected right, creating a very awkward context for Indigenous fishers in this country who want to fish commercially. What's most recently happened on the East Coast is that Sebeginagadi fishers have, as a community and as a collective, they've created their own fisheries management plan and allocated their own licenses for their fishers to go out and harvest lobster to obtain a moderate livelihood. And this is a very limited number of licenses in this one community. I think the last stats that I heard, and things could have changed in the past few weeks, but there were 7 licenses granted to community members, and each of those licenses was for only 50 traps. So we're talking about 350 traps, which is not even a drop in the bucket compared to the more than 900 non-Indigenous commercial licenses that are granted in this area that are each fishing hundreds of traps. And so there's a huge kind of discrepancy in scale here. What's really important to think about in this context is that this isn't a free-for-all. It wasn't just people going out willy-nilly. There was a very detailed management plan put in place. It was part of a structure. It was part of a community-based decision to exercise that constitutionally protected right. But it's, like you said, Leanne, it's led to a great deal of conflict and huge violence on the East Coast where boats have been burned. Paint thinner has been poured on lobster catch that's been caught by Indigenous fishers. There have been attacks and threats, and it's been really horrifying to watch in reality. And it's hard to talk about because it's hard to see those things happening in our country to Indigenous fishers here. But the situation is constantly evolving. On the East Coast, there is a huge industrial fishing company called Clearwater that has been largely kind of initially was not a huge part of the conversation, but they are the company that most non-Indigenous fishers belong to and bring their catch to and that kind of thing. But a recent large purchase was made involving East Coast Mi'kmaq communities alongside a BC First Nations organization to purchase half of Clearwater. So this massive company is now half Indigenous owned. And so there's a real big question as to what the future holds here. And I am not an oracle. I have no idea where this is going to lead. It's really time for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada and for the Canadian government to step up and to recognize their role in creating a pathway so that fishers can exercise their constitutionally protected right to fish for a moderate livelihood. And we really need to have a national conversation about what a moderate livelihood is and why is it that Indigenous fishers can only earn a moderate one? Why does it have to be regulated in such a way when non-Indigenous fishers don't share those same kinds of regulations and added burdens?
I see there being two layers here as far as where we're probably missing the boat on making sure that we are being inclusive and working together with Indigenous communities. And this conflict is just one example of many that are happening across Canada and the US, as you said. I feel like this is happening not only at the level of fishers, as far as they were the ones who seemed to be very upset and perhaps the ones who were actually perpetuating that direct violence you described, but also the systems of fisheries management, the way that they're set up and the fact that, you know, we have what we think of as our normal fisheries management, and then there's tribal fisheries management, and these are not things that work together, and we don't really integrate any sort of Indigenous frameworks in the way that we do our fisheries management, as far as I've seen. This is a really hard question. Obviously, I don't expect you to have all the answers, but I wonder if you have any insight or suggestions on ways that we can move forward to learn from these incidences to make sure that we can, you know, in some way make fishery science better to avoid these sorts of conflicts and really work together as a society.
Yeah, I love this question, Leon. I think it's super well placed and something that we need to be collectively talking about. I've been really marked by conversations that I've had the privilege to have with Mi'kmaq elder Dr. Albert Marshall from the Eskazoni First Nation, who's a carrier of the teaching of Etawuptamuk, which is loosely translated to two-eyed seeing. Or seeing the world through multiple perspectives, learning to see from one eye with the strengths of Indigenous knowledges and ways of knowing, and from the other eye with dominant mainstream or conventional knowledges and ways of knowing, and learning to use both these eyes together for the benefit of all. And when he and I have talked about what's currently happening in Mi'kma'ki and Mi'kmaq homelands, he really sees so much of this conflict as a failure to reconcile ways of knowing and ways of being, that we've really gotten caught up in these political conversations about conservation and about this moderate livelihood and what that even means. But he really sees those as distractions from the bigger issue. And what this fundamentally is a question of rights. This is a rights-based fishery. The question needs to just turn towards how we allow those rights to be exercised. And for him, and for me too, we both really see power in Etawuptamuk for reshaping how we do science and how we reconcile ways of knowing, instead of trying, like you said, trying to make tribal or Indigenous fisheries and that worldview and all that comes with that fit within some Western scientific or colonial framework. The two need to have the space to operate in parallel and separately, but to learn from both. We're at a point where we're facing such strong ecological and fisheries crises that we need all of the best tools that are available at our disposal. And those might stem from Western science and they might stem from Indigenous knowledge systems. It's really about gathering those pieces of information, those methodologies that help us get to a better future, that help us get to a point where we're not facing this current reality that is so tense and clearly not benefiting anyone involved.
You hear a lot about conflict resolution and compromise and collaboration. How does that play into the two-eyed seeing that you just discussed?
Well, for two-eyed seeing to take place, a lot of people talk about this idea of ethical space. of that there needs to be space created for the two to come together or more. It's not really about just seeing with two perspectives, but it can be as many. It can be, it's about epistemic pluralism, about how we create space for multiple ways of knowing, multiple perspectives, recognizing fundamentally there's no single right way of seeing the world or being in it. And so this idea of ethical space, it's really meant to confront those strong power imbalances that inherently exist within our political systems, within our institutions. When we as researchers go to do work that is on traditional territories or that involves Indigenous communities, there is a huge power differential when government enacts these regulations and imposes them in this top-down way. There's a huge power difference that needs to be recognized and really reconciled if we're going to move forward in a more collaborative way that doesn't lead to these intense conflicts. So I think it's a question of how we create that ethical space. And I think we're increasingly learning tools that help get us there. But I think a fundamental part is recognizing our own positionality and how we situate ourselves in relation to our work and really confront those privileges that we all carry and the values that we carry that shape the work that we do.
So actually, if anyone listening wants to learn more, as you should, about two-eyed seeing and thinking about it in the context of case studies within fisheries management, Andrea's paper titled Two-Eyed Seeing, an Indigenous Framework to Transform Fisheries Research and Management. So that should be accessible to most people with access to databases.
Leon, so this paper is out in Fish and Fisheries, which is one of the top journals out there related to fishery science, and it's open access. So anybody can click the link and go to it and read. And I think after what we've just heard, everybody who's listening to this podcast should go and check out Two-Eyed Seeing.
Well, I appreciate the plug. I definitely want to add, man, I feel like I'm full of caveats today, but Two-Eyed Seeing, I think it holds such power, and I think it can really change the way that we think about how we do science and carry out management and all those kinds of things. But I really also want to point out that it's not a panacea. It is not the solution to all of our problems. But as we make really clear in the paper too, there's really neat Indigenous conceptual frameworks from around the world that also create these pathways to epistemic pluralism. And really what we need to be working towards is that, about how we create space for those multiple ways of knowing and being. And I think Two-Eyed Seeing is one route there. It's not the only route there. But I really appreciate the push for the paper. Thank you both.
This is Mary Webbin Morin from AFS headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland. And did you know that AFS has a summer internship program for high school students who are interested in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences? Our goal of the Hutton Junior Fisheries Biology Program is to recruit students from underrepresented backgrounds in science careers and use this internship to introduce and inspire the students to continue on a path to become a fisheries professional. This paid internship is between 7 and 8 weeks long, and the students receive $3,000. Since the program's inception in 2001, the Hutton program has placed 717 high school students from the United States, Mexico, and Canada in hands-on research-based internships with current fisheries professionals. We are always looking for interested mentors to recruit students in their local areas to apply to the program. You are the inspiration for the next generation of fisheries professionals. Now let's hear from some Hutton program alumni about their time participating in the program.
The Hutton program was a great experience for me. During my internship with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, I learned many things about the fisheries and environmental field. This program was a hands-on experience because I was able to perform fieldwork in several areas around my state, was exposed to a professional environment, and worked with professionals. This is a very rewarding program.
Ready to get hooked on the Hutton program? AFS is recruiting fisheries professionals to serve as mentors, whether in freshwater, marine, or aquaculture settings. Donate financially or in kind as a volunteer today. Visit the Hutton website for additional information and to donate and help the future generation of fisheries professionals.
So you're about to start a new job. Congrats. What are some of the research topics and impacts that you aim to accomplish with your new job? Where are you? Where are you going? And what are you doing?
Well, so I've just finished my PhD focused on Pacific salmon fisheries. I was based at Carleton University for that. And I'm coming to you from my home office right now, surrounded by boxes and filled with books and getting ready to head to the West Coast. So I've got an assistant professorship waiting for me at the University of British Columbia. I'll be joining the Institute for the Oceans and Fisheries, and I'll be helping to lead a new research group there that is called the Indigenous Fisheries Research Unit that has a very broad mandate. Our focus is going to be to work on culturally significant fish and fisheries, which in my view is most fish and fisheries around the world. My focus is going to really be on British Columbia First Nations, working with communities in that province and on waterways there, but with substantial scope for collaborations across Canada, working with my colleagues in Mi'kma'ki and colleagues in the Great Lakes, kind of across the country, because the reality really is so shared in many of these places. But also I see scope too for working around the world on some of these things. My ambition really is to promote the conservation and protection of these fish and fisheries, and to do so by having Indigenous partners as a partner in the entire research process, that it really is co-produced science from the ground up, and that it's positioned to meet community needs and to center community values in the work. For so long, Western science has really carried out this type of research that's been defined by parachute scientists coming into communities with external interests in mind and kind of external benefits in mind, not really doing work for communities or on their terms. So I'm wanting to turn that dynamic on its head and to create space for Indigenous students to really feel like they have a home in this work, that they don't have to abandon Indigenous worldviews and ways of thinking in order to enter the academy. So those are some of the core foundations of what I will be doing starting this January. Really excited to just see that there are these parallels and shared interests across Turtle Island and around the world. And yeah, I think that there's just such a power in collaborating and learning from one another. So that's something that I really want to do throughout my research program moving forward.
And when you said First Nations, what are you referring to when you say First Nations that you're working with in BC?
Yeah, so this is an important conversation to have, especially when we're talking on either side of the medicine line or the border between Canada and the US. In the Canadian context, I mean, we have many different Indigenous communities here that are broadly grouped into three main kind of categories. We have First Nations communities, which is the majority of Indigenous communities in this country. There are also Métis groups in this country who are descendants from the Red River Nation and who have mixed European and Indigenous ancestry. And then way up north in the territories are the Inuit. And so First Nations are very diverse Indigenous communities in this country. And in British Columbia alone, there are about 200 of them, just to give you a rough sense of how many different peoples we're talking about.
I mean, that really speaks to the diversity in people, not only in Canada, but worldwide.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd love to talk more about non-Indigenous fisheries professionals can do essentially to be better educated on these Indigenous frameworks that you're talking about, and being able to work together with Indigenous communities in a way that is not from a colonizer mindset, as in, you know, we teach you or, things like that, or that our way is better, but that we are looking at it through the two-eyed seeing you're talking about, that, you know, we have just as much to learn from Indigenous communities about fisheries management. And there are obviously ways that we can work better together. And there's some things that I've seen done, including on Canada Day itself. These seem like little things to me, but for example, doing land acknowledgements. So I noticed this a couple of years ago, starting in my seminar series, the beginning of a talk, the person saying, you know, the land I'm on, for example, I'm currently in the territories of the Nipmuc, Wabanaki, and Pocumtuk tribes. On Canada Day, literally every speaker, I think, you know, gave their land acknowledgments, and that was so striking. And I know that AFS, you know, they were struck by that as well. You know, it was very powerful to see everyone acknowledging whose land they were on. And I noticed something else in your paper, the Two-Eyed Seeing paper, that initial statement of positionality, which I actually have never seen in another paper. And maybe that's because I'm not in this literature as much, since I'm more of a fish biologist and ecologist, but it was positioning, it seemed to me, which please correct me if I don't describe this correctly, it seemed as if it was positioning who you are, speaking about the elder Albert Marshall and who he is, what tribe he comes from, and then speaking also about the mentors for you in the process of doing the research. These seem like, you know, very small things that people do, but what does it mean to you when you see people making these land acknowledgments and positionality statements?
It's a really good set of questions, and I'm glad that you brought up land acknowledgements specifically, because there really is this trend towards giving them and them being part of our classrooms, that they're part of every kind of congregation. Every time that we meet in large numbers, they get done, at least increasingly so in Canada. And they are wonderful things if they are done in the right way. There's a wonderful author, Chelsea Vowell, who says that they can be potential sites of disruption if we allow them to be. But too often we let them be kind of meaningless because they can so easily just be canned and not sincere. If they cause you to think about whose lands and waters are under your feet and to really reflect on that history and what that actually means for Indigenous peoples in the present, without that being part of the process, they can just be this repetition of something really meaningless and lose that potential power and that weight. So I really encourage folks to think about the power that they hold in doing these things, that it really needs to go beyond words and really move into action. We really need to say, yes, so these are the lands and waters under our feet. We really need to move beyond that to these are the lands and waters beneath our feet, and here is what we are compelled to do about it. And so I think it's increasingly the case that people are starting to write their own land acknowledgments and to confront that history and to think about it. And I just strongly encourage people to move in that direction. On your question about the positionality statement, that is, it's definitely true that it's more of a characteristic of Indigenous scholarship. If you read some key books and papers in this space, you'll see that it's more of a practice there. But I'm so pleased to, through this paper on Two-Eyed Seeing and Fish and Fisheries, to begin to create space for carrying that practice into the world of fish and fisheries, and to now see that there have been other author teams who have now used our paper, even though it only recently came out, but as an example for creating space for others to do the same in this world of fish and fisheries. And so I think we really need to, in these cases, lead by example, but by having those uncomfortable conversations where the part of the editorial team said that it wasn't the convention, that they didn't want to see it included, but we asked for it to stay, and they were happy to see it stay. They just at first weren't sure what to do with it or what to make of it. And circling back to this, to our conversation on terminology and on language, I think that so often people are really afraid to, they're afraid to make a mistake or to say the wrong thing. And we really all have an obligation to be part of these conversations and to educate ourselves so that we have the ability to have these discussions. And it's really important that that burden doesn't always fall on Indigenous peoples or people of color to be the ones navigating that space. It really needs to be a shared conversation, and for settlers to do their homework and their part in creating a better reality. I mean, by not changing how we're operating now. We're actively choosing to uphold the status quo, which is very much colonial. And tying this all into land acknowledgements, what we now call crown or public land, it really was taken or stolen from peoples across this continent through force, through ill will, through deception. And we all descend from that history, no matter what side of that spectrum we're on. And we all have a responsibility to make things right by involving communities where and when they want to be involved, by attending to community needs. There's a really wonderful paper in Nature in 2007, led by Sheila Jasanoff, on the technologies of humility. And I really encourage people to go check out that paper. But she essentially asks us to reframe our problems so that ethical dimensions are brought to light. She has some really powerful words on this subject, and I have her paper here, and I just wanted to share kind of one of her short paragraphs on this. Humility instructs us to think harder about how we reframe problems so that their ethical dimensions are brought to light, which new facts to seek, and when to resist asking science for clarification. Humility directs us to alleviate known causes of people's vulnerability to harm, to pay attention to the distribution of risks and benefits, and to reflect on the social factors that promote or discourage learning. Policies based on humility might redress inequality before finding out how the poor are hurt by climate change, value greenhouse gases differently depending on the nature of the activities that give rise to them, and uncover the sources of vulnerability in fishing communities before installing expensive tsunami detection systems. This call for humility is a plea for policymakers to cultivate and for universities to teach modes of knowing that are often pushed aside in expanding scientific understanding and technological capacity. It is a request for research on what people value and why they value it. And I really love that message. And I think it's something we all need to carry in our work.
You have picked all amazing things to read and educate us with. I so appreciate it. I know I'm going to at least ask you for all of these resources so we can share them later on as well. This kind of reminds me of like exceptionalism, because there's been a lot of conversations about like American exceptionalism in recent weeks. And just this idea that, you know, we have to admit that we are not necessarily the best, or that we are the only people who know the way things should be, for example, in fishery science, just because we started with a certain mindset and have been studying and learning and teaching fishery science a certain way, that doesn't mean that it's the best way to do things just because that's the way it's been done for so long. And this is definitely a time of reckoning where we need to have that humility and say, there are other ways to do this, and they are very possibly better ways to do this, especially in the US where we have fish stocks. You know, we have some that are doing well and some that are not doing so well. And there's just a lot of opportunity here, I think. For, you know, fisheries professionals, obviously we're all educated somewhere, usually in academia. Do you think that, what are important things for people who are learning about fishery science in academia, the professors who are teaching those students, what are important things that they could do to engage with and support Indigenous communities? And then the same thing for actual fisheries professionals who are in the workforce. Like, what are things that we can actually do to move forward and work together with Indigenous communities?
There's this saying that we're all treaty people, and it really speaks to that kind of shared responsibility that we all have a role to play in this. And I think that there are many things that we can do, but to kind of repeat myself, sorry, but we all have a responsibility to educate ourselves, to learn that history and to learn how to honor it for ourselves, given our own positionality. I think that there are things that we can do along the lines of land acknowledgements and positionality statements, but that really needs to, like you said, create a reckoning. So we think about how to carry out actions that uphold those responsibilities, that bring those words into action. And it really depends on the context. But in so many cases, we have had this one approach to doing fisheries science that has left no space for other ways. So I think we need a profound rethinking about how we go about work that influences communities and how they're involved in those processes. As one example, I mean, if we take the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which people are increasingly familiar with, and understand that it means that Indigenous peoples have a right to be at the decision-making table and have free, prior, and informed consent on things that happen in their territories. But how many of us have actually gone out and read UNDRIP? How many people in Canada know the Truth and Reconciliation Calls to Action? That's where we need to start, is to ready ourselves by knowing what it is that we're talking about, by knowing what Indigenous rights are and how we can uphold and respect them through our actions. There's a lot to say in this space, so I don't want to go on too much at length.
You know, I've seen that same critique that you had about land acknowledgements when on Twitter, that people are saying that it can be performative and it can, you know, lead to feeling like, oh, I've done enough, you know, that's enough to be supporting Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm sure that our listeners are just looking for ways, you know, what does it mean to actually perform action? But I think I hear what you're saying is to make space at the table and to listen and to actually work together, as you said, to co-produce knowledge and co-manage, I think it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. To create space at the decision-making table, to create space in our classrooms, to have Indigenous leadership be recognized, and for Indigenous governance structures to really hold the weight that they ought to. It's a part of a way bigger narrative around land back, around restoring sovereignty to Indigenous nations and having nations have say in these processes in science and in whatever takes place on lands and waters that affect their people, their communities.
As I mentioned, you know, I, as a woman of color, definitely look up to you and just amazed by how eloquent you are, how much you've accomplished, and the fact that you already have a professor position at the University of British Columbia, which is just an amazing place for fish. So it's just all, you know, wonderful. And I can only imagine that young Indigenous people would look up to you and just be, you know, so happy to have someone that they can look to as a role model. So do you have anything that you, you know, would like to take this time to speak to those young Indigenous people who are considering a career in fisheries or related fields?
Come join me at the Indigenous Fisheries Research Unit. I mean, that's really tongue in cheek, but I really think that it's important that we start to see ourselves in the academy, that we need to find mentors that, you know, understand our world and don't ask us to walk away from what we carry into it so that we can join those groups, right? There are increasingly amazing Indigenous scholars in leadership positions, and I'm really convinced that from the responses I've already kind of been receiving from Indigenous students across the country before I even step into this position, these sorts of changes that like the creation of the Indigenous Fisheries Research Unit, they're game-changing for many. I've received a lot of prospective student interest, and I'm just so pleased to say that the majority has been from up-and-coming Indigenous fisheries scientists. And I thought that that was going to have to be something that I slowly worked towards and learned how to recruit and learned how to find those connections to communities. But I'm really rapidly finding that students are finding me very quickly, and that they see such a need for this kind of work and a need for the creation of research groups like this. It really is a vacuum in the academy. And I think that's why I've been able to find a space to do this work so readily out of my degree, because there's just a massive need for it. And the fact that there are these amazing students that I can't wait to work with that are so well positioned to lead fisheries work in and for their communities, I'm just delighted at all of those possibilities. But
I'm so glad to hear you have so much interest from, you know, Indigenous students. And I think it's also an important point for us non-Indigenous folks to recognize that Indigenous students are there and Indigenous talent is here. We have to make sure that we're doing the work to educate ourselves and make the fisheries profession an inclusive, welcoming place for them, so that they don't feel like they have to leave later on down the road once they're ready to actually enter the workforce. So we've got work on our side, and so appreciative that you are, you know, transforming the landscape in Canada, but hopefully also working with us in the US, because we, you know, we'd greatly appreciate that. I think we probably are just about ready to wrap up. You've given us so many, you know, excellent authors, like potential readings we can do. Are there any other ones that you would like to recommend to our listeners, or talks you think we should listen to?
I have a massive reading list, but I've benefited so much from reading amazing Indigenous scholars and non-Indigenous scholars as well to educate myself on these topics, because I've come into this world that was a void, that I haven't had Indigenous fisheries scientists in the academy to learn from. And so I've had to turn to other disciplines and help bring those teachings and learnings in. And so I would be happy to recommend some folks that people should check out. But certainly Sean Wilson's Research is Ceremony is essential reading for people in fisheries and outside of fisheries. It is very broadly applicable to all disciplines. Linda Tuhiwai Smith's Decolonizing Methodologies is a very classic and essential read, but I would be happy to share a short list. I recently compiled the list of 20 essential readings for carrying out two-eyed seeing in fisheries research and beyond for the Lakes Letter newsletter. So I'd be happy to share that with you folks and with the listeners.
Please do. And we'll actually link that directly to the Fisheries Podcast link, and then people can dig right in.
Great. I also wanted to add, just, I feel like there's something floating around in my head that ties to something Leon said early on about just the kind of underrepresentation of Indigenous fisheries professionals within the American Fisheries Society and within the fisheries discipline at large. And it's such a juxtaposition, and it stands in such stark opposition for me when we look at communities across Turtle Island that are so fish and fisheries centric, that if you were to, you know, go and ask the average person in community information about the fish, so many people are eager to talk about it, they're passionate about these things and very knowledgeable about their fish and fisheries, probably more so than the average non-Indigenous person walking around whatever city. And I think that we really need to think about how we're creating these institutions and educational systems to prepare the next generation of fisheries and wildlife professionals, that it shouldn't be that way. There's so much expertise within Indigenous communities. They're already, their elders are very much scientists who have scientific understandings of the world. They don't need to go to a Western science institution in order to be rendered valid. So we need to think about maybe new ways of creating fisheries professionals so that we recognize that expertise from within community, that they don't need to necessarily leave community or learn from external people in order to be equipped and ready to be fish and water protectors moving forward.
Absolutely. I think that is a wonderful and important note for us to end on today. Thank you so much for being here and answering all of our questions. Really appreciate it. And I think we wish you all the best of luck in your job. And we're just looking forward to seeing what other amazing things come from you and your research.
Andrea, I'd like to also say thank you. This has been a great experience talking with you. And it really takes on some of the concepts that you discussed in your plenary talk and really wanted to even more of a deep dive. And I think we can speak for the whole podcast team that we really appreciate your efforts and appreciate you being on the podcast. So thank you very much.
You're most welcome. It was an absolute pleasure to be here and speak with you both on these things, that on these topics that I really hold dear. And I'm really, yeah, delighted to get to enter into the ears and thoughts of all of these people spread across Turtle Island. So go out there and protect our fish and waters.
All right, Erin, we just had finished our conversation with Dr. Andrea Reed, and It was amazing. She gave us so many insights, so many quotable things, and I feel like I just have so much to think about now, especially in thinking about how we as fishery scientists can just do better and think about how we can integrate this to white seeing. So do you have any things that, you know, really stuck out to you?
A couple of different things stuck out to me. And I'll first start by saying, Leon, you did great in your first podcast ever. I appreciate, and so does Dion, you joining the team. Hey, this is why we asked you, because we knew that you were going to be good. One of the things that really stuck out to me was I've always understood this interconnectedness with nature that was in that community, right? It's in a lot of the movies that you see or the books that you read or just your understanding of those cultures. What I didn't really think about in the past is how that is in terms of how fish are as a gift or even a relative of those communities versus just the commodity that a lot of other cultures see fisheries resources as. So she mentioned that and discussed that, and that really stood out to me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think when she was speaking about, you know, those three ways that Indigenous communities, you know, view fish differently than Western, like traditional Western thought, I just kept thinking like, wow, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. You know, it's just very striking to me. And I also was immediately thinking, you know, like, what would it look like if in a fisheries management or fisheries science classroom, we were to teach our science that way? I feel like it would be radically different. And I would guess to our benefit, and it would take a lot of work. But I think that's where I was just like going, like, you know, what does it look like for us to use the two-eyed seeing that she was talking about and really consider these two different ways of looking at fish and fish populations to really make space for both of these things together. So just lots of things that we as a society and workforce can think about for the future.
Another thing that stood out to me was her, what she referred to as parachute scientists. At first, I didn't know what she was talking about, but then she described how these scientists can come in and not do work for the community or on their terms. There's ulterior motives or other reasons that science is being done, but not necessarily for the Indigenous peoples. So that also stood out. I mean, the whole podcast stood out really because she's so eloquent. And listening to her plenary and also talking to her today, she has a very calming voice. She has a very passionate and calming voice that really shines through.
You can do some meditation tapes. I'll buy that.
Yeah, we should tell her to do that. Tell her to go into a meditation and make some side money on meditation.
Yeah, she can do like 15 minutes of regular meditation and then start talking about all these important concepts we just talked about and sort of like in people's sleep. Just start to change their mindsets from the ground up.
Well, that's hilarious. Something that I saw online that our listeners may be interested in when we're talking about Native lands and the Indigenous peoples, that whole conversation about, well, what was the term that you used?
Land acknowledgement.
If you're interested in like, okay, well, what land, what Native American land am I standing on right now? All you have to do is go to a website that's developed specifically for this purpose. It's called native-land.ca. And basically there's polygons surrounding all these different Native American lands.
Yeah, and we'll leave you with the challenge of not only knowing whose land you're on, but considering what the implications are for us as people who are living there and are not Indigenous. All right, I think that's it for us today. Thank you for listening.
Hi, everybody.
Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com and for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. This episode was produced and edited by Aaron Bunch and Dion Kerr. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.